Blog Talk Radio.
Desperate quest for perfection. The beauty in the miracle, bringing a perfect of extreme. Time to take it and change direction. It's up to me to block it out. It's up to me to lock down.
Well, hello and welcome to Voices of the Sacred Feminine on yet another Wednesday night. In this busy world, I know you have lots to choose from to occupy your time and things to do. So it is honestly and truly an honor when you take the time to be here with me and my wonderful guests. So thank you. And I hope you're enjoying the summer. I know with everything going on out there in the world, it can be ugly out there. But, you know, we have to look for inspiration. We have to seek out those glimmers that give us hope and, you know, just keep that gas in our tank. Even if it means something simple like making the time to, you know, carve out to soak in a wonderful bath with some scented candles. Maybe it's petting our beloved cat and just hearing that calming purr, or when was the last time you stopped and really looked at the beauty and intricacy of a flower in your garden, or maybe your neighbor's garden, or at the grocery store? You know, maybe it's looking for those around us who are trying to make a difference, whatever that is, and giving them a shout or an email, or maybe mailing them a card to say thank you. You know, that reminds me of an exercise we were doing in the final Cake for the Queen of Heaven class this past Saturday that I was teaching at the Goddess Temple in Orange County on feminist theology. The exercise that was called for in the curriculum was to have women imagine a day in their future when their community was gathered to give them accolades for something they accomplished. Well, you know, I didn't expect this to be what happened as a result of that exercise, but it turned out it was really hard for some of the women to create that vision, that dream, that fantasy in their mind. Maybe that was because we women so often are used to enduring, to being of service, for what we do for others, sometimes being taken for granted. So let me just suggest that as we do what we can to rethink and restructure our society with new and more meaningful values, let's make one of our ideals to create rituals, not only that honor important life passages, you know, our body, sexuality, and our sacred blood, but let's regularly give accolades to the women and men in our lives that deserve recognition. You know, if there's someone around you that's doing good work, tell them. You know, don't assume they get enough appreciation or recognition or any at all. You know, we should get in the habit of doing that. And we shouldn't have trouble imagining success and receiving support and acknowledgement. You know, we should just take it in, receive it, let it fuel us, let it grow us, and let it make us more healthy and whole. So anyway, just some food for thought that came out of that class exercise. So that's my inspiration for this week. And the rest I'll have to leave to our wonderful guests. And we have two for you tonight for your pleasure as we celebrate our summer series, Sacred Destinations. The first guest tonight coming on with us for about an hour is Lydia Rule. She is a favorite returning. And she is going to be talking to us about the goddess Kuan Yin in Asia. And then at about 7 o'clock, we have the author Gloria Amendola coming on the show. And the topic we'll be discussing with Gloria is the Magdalene energies in the lands of southern France. So I think we have two great shows for you tonight. I hope you'll stay tuned in for the entire show. So let's get right to Lydia. And if by chance this is the first time you're hearing Lydia, let me tell you a little bit about her just as by way of an introduction. She is an artist scholar emeritus of the visual arts faculty of the University of Northern California in Greeley, Colorado. She has a Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Colorado at Boulder, a Master of Arts from UNC, and she studied with Syracuse University in Italy, France, Spain, and with the Art Institute of Chicago in Indonesia. She works regularly at Santa Reparata International School of Art in Florence, Italy, and Columbia College Center for Book and Paper in Chicago. Her research into sacred images of women has taken her around the globe, so that's why she is a great guest to talk to us about Kuan Yin in Asia, because this is a lady who has been everywhere. For 7 years, Lydia led women's pilgrimage journeys to sacred places. She creates and exhibits her art and does workshops throughout the U.S. and internationally. And her goddess icon spirit banners, please Google that. Maybe you can look at that while you're listening to our interview tonight. Goddess icon spirit banners or LydiaRule.com. These beautiful girls of Lydia's, ambassadors of goddess, or the sacred feminine, I like to call them, well, they have flown in prestigious places all around the world, in countries like Australia, Canada, Britain, France, Luxembourg, Italy, Greece, Serbia, Bulgaria, Germany, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, Turkey, Ghana, Kenya, Costa Rica. I could go on, and the list continues. They really do spread the divine feminine energies in a way that art only can. And she has a book out about these goddess icon spirit banners of that very same name, Goddess Icon Spirit Banners of the Divine Feminine. So please look it up while we talk. And Lydia, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Karen, for inviting me back. I enjoy it immensely.
Well, good, good. And I always enjoy talking to you. You always teach me something new. And you're just back from another of your many, many trips. Were you doing goddess-oriented work, or was it, what was your last trip that you're only home a couple days from?
Well, I started in Italy, in Rome, with my entire family of 14. So that was quite a journey to celebrate my 75th birthday, which is next week on August 4th.
Oh, the same day as Barack Obama, right?
That's right. And our son Steve was also born on my birthday. So we were celebrating, and my husband Bob was 75 in April. So the journey to Italy was in birthday celebrations, and we followed the goddesses there. Then I did a goddess Anatolia, the 20th anniversary of my first journey there on the Trail of the Mother Goddess with Rashid Erginer. Following that, I went to Bavaria to the Hagia Academy and was involved last week in studying matriarchal studies in the cultures of the world. So it's been quite a span.
You're not kidding. Well, before we move on to other things, I want to make sure I take a second here and say happy birthday.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
So, Lydia, I have to ask you, just as, you know, a traveler myself who sometimes becomes weary of the grind of the airports and the getting up early and being on the bus and all of that sort of thing, you probably did this a little differently with family and, you know, by your description of the trip. It wasn't like you were with a tour per se, but do you ever get weary of the travel, or does it still just inspire you like in those early days?
Well, I enjoy it. There's no doubt about that. But as I was glad to get home, put it that way. After a month being gone, it is a grind. It isn't a grind. I just missed my own bed and my own peace and quiet. The family is always busy, and then the tour of Turkey, we covered an awfully lot of territory. And then we spent the week in Bavaria, and that was with a group of about 20 women. So my peace and quiet was very nice today.
Well, I just have to ask you as a funny aside, when you get home, do you always crave a particular food that you just can't get over in Europe or somewhere?
Yes, and that's Mexican food. See, we, in Colorado, that's what I really love here, and they cannot do Mexican in Europe.
Well, you know, I don't know if you heard that gasp, but that's exactly the thing I always crave, too. As soon as we get home, we have to hit a good Mexican restaurant, because you're right, you just can't get good Mexican food over in Europe.
They can't do the taste.
I remember my first trip to Egypt. We stayed at a Sheraton, and they were having a Mexican fiesta. Let me tell you, it was not good. Well, but anyway, let's go ahead and move on to Kuan Yin in Asia. And just on the off chance that some of my maybe new listeners maybe don't know about the Asian goddess Kuan Yin, why don't you start off by, you know, telling us who she is and some of her histories?
Well, I got interested in China and the goddesses there as part of my goddess banner family, which I affectionately call the girls, and you referred to them. So I was going to China in the early 2003, and I began looking at images seriously about what I would choose. And I discovered that Kuan Yin was such an important image. When I started researching, I realized that she kind of developed and evolved from the Buddhist idea of a bodhisattva of compassion whose name was Avalokiteshvara. So you'll have some mouthfuls to this on this show tonight. Buddhism happened, you know, 500 years before the advent of the Common Era or Christ, and then it traveled on the trader's routes. So there literally was a road from China to the Mediterranean, to the Roman world. And on that road, traders brought their goods and also their images. So the first images of Kuan Yin appeared in caves in western China around, they are called the Magao Caves near Dunhuang, and it's out in the Kukulcan Desert. What traders would do, I gather, is make some images to make sure that they were safe, that their travels would go safely, and if that happened, then they would return and make more images. So Kuan Yin appeared on some banners or flags, silk flags there, to protect the people, and so that's where she first began to appear, or the male bodhisattva became feminine.
So, Lydia, how did that come to be? Because we know Buddhism is so patriarchal. Do you find it surprising that we end up with a female bodhisattva?
Well, no, because that seems to be what's happened even in, especially in Christianity.
Oh, that's true with Mary.
Yeah, that the mate patriarchal religions can't get along without some kind of a feminine energy and spirit. And so Kuan Yin, in essence, becomes the Mary of Chinese Buddhism, not India Buddhism, but Chinese Buddhism. And then, as you know, Buddhism kind of died out in India in around the 12th century Common Era, and it moved into Southeast Asia, into Cambodia. And so there you found the bringing of that idea and some wonderful feminine divine images there in Angkor Wat. So the idea that you had to have a feminine spirit or a feminine divine human beings crave, it appears to me.
Okay. Now, are you saying in, I'm sorry, it just went right out of my head. The destination you just said.
Talking about Cambodia.
Cambodia.
But what happens with Kuan Yin, or a feminine spirit, feminine divine, she's all over Asia. And she gets a different name in Southeast Asia. So maybe we ought to just stick with China for a little bit, and then
okay,
we can move down there.
Okay.
So the Chinese appear to have been receptive and needing some image, an idea with which to ask for help. And so Kuan Yin's title is She Who Listens to the Cries of the World, or Hears the Cries of the World. So if you want something, help for healing, help for a good life, a good death, help for your safe travels, you would make an offering to her. And offerings mean sometimes food, sometimes incense, sometimes banners, sometimes spirit money. You know, in Chinese temples, there are papers that are used as spirit money that you transform by burning. And at Kuan Yin shrines, that's very prevalent. I mean, that's what you do when you enter. You get a candle or a taper and some incense, and you light it and put it on the altars. And you can also then get spirit money and burn it as well.
So is the idea as you burn the money, you're asking for abundance to come to you?
Yes, or healing or safety. Or I suppose you could even ask for a lover. I don't know. But it's a request to She Who Listens to the Cries of the World, and especially you. There seems to be a real personal relationship with Kuan Yin. She's the figure that's on home altars. She's the figure in the temples where the ashes of the dead are. She's the person, or she's the feminine divine. She's the great goddess.
Okay.
She also is represented in the landscape as a mountain, and her sacred mountain is in the East China Sea. It's called Putuoshan. I visited there in 2003, along with thousands and thousands of other pilgrims. You have to take a boat from the mainland of China, Ningbo, out into to the island, and I think it's about 4 hours on the boat ferry. And I was told that there are at least 4 to 6 million pilgrims a year going to Putuoshan, which is her sacred island, and a mountain on it where you request your help from her, or if you've been healed, you say thank you. The stories are endless about how she has affected people's lives.
Well, I know when we did a military ritual in the summer, Kuan Yin was the goddess that we used as for healing of, you know, of the soldiers, of people left behind. Mm-hmm. And there were all sorts of stories of, people said that, they believed that they prayed to her and, you know, she would save them from exploding bombs. I mean, her stories really, really are countless.
Yes, they are. And so she becomes this great mother that you are wanting to be in her presence, or she in your presence to help you.
Well, you know, I have a curious question for you, and I'm just wondering if what your gut reaction is. I had an ISIS scholar say to me that she thought that ISIS and Kuan Yin may have been related, that Kuan Yin, attributes and everything may have come from, you know, this, like you were talking about, that Silk Road, you know, from China, you know, down into the Mediterranean area. We know ISIS was worshipped there. Do you really think there's maybe any connection there?
Well, if she sees one, maybe she can research it. From what I've read, she seems to have arisen from the Buddhist tradition, which really didn't come from Egypt. And then China itself has many other layers preceding Buddhism and Kuan Yin. There was during the Han Dynasty, and this is several hundred years before the Common Era, and about the same time that Buddhism arose, there was a great Queen Mother of the West. Her name was Shi Huangmu. and you wanted to, like in Egypt in a way, you go to the Great Western Mountains, your souls go there when you die. So she was on many tombs and on many tiles, seated on her throne, and with her sacred animals around her. So she was part of the tradition before Kuan Yin.
Okay.
And, then there's other great mothers. Do Mu was a Taoist goddess who has the sun and the moon in her many arms. And she, again, is that great mother. So they are all related in my mind because of their connections to my goddess banner tradition circling the world. It seems there are many great mothers, and Isis certainly is one.
Go ahead. You were.
I don't fear getting to China per se, but
yeah,
you know
what's
interesting, it seems, is that when the Virgin Mary was such a strong occurrence in the Middle Ages, 12th to the 14th century, there seems to be a rise in Kuan Yin. In fact, that's the first time that she's shown with a child. So up until then, she's alone. But around the 12th century, she has a son on her lap. And so it probably was the influence of the traders again,
right,
bringing the stories, either on the Silk Road or on the oceans.
And was this child on her lap actually, I mean, I heard you say son, but did you, I mean, do the stories change where she actually has a male child?
No. She is who you appeal to for a son.
Ah.
So she's called Kuan Yin, white-robed Kuan Yin, who brings a son. And in the Oriental traditions, the son is the person that you always want to bring into the world. I don't get it.
So they're not praying for girls, is your point?
Yeah, right. I would hope you'd pray for girls so your life continued.
Well, you know, they say with all the infanticide in China, there's actually a shortage of girls, I believe.
Oh,
I read someplace.
On the cover of The Economist magazine in January or February this year, it said it's a genocide. For at least 50 million girls have either not been born, and this is going to cause a tremendous imbalance in the population.
Wow.
Because if you don't have women for men, it causes all kinds of social issues that could go on and on.
Well, let's, getting back to Kuan Yin, although that is very interesting, and it amazes me that it isn't talked about more in our country. It's like they just as well be on another planet with that problem. And it is so important to us, you know, within goddess spirituality, because, again, you know, this is the oppression of women in patriarchal, male-dominated world. You know, that's just one of the symptoms.
Yeah.
But Kuan Yin, she's depicted a lot of different ways, true?
Yes. So she can be standing with and often holding a willow and a vessel of water, symbolizing new life and that everything has to have water to live. So she's the source of water, and her sacred island is in the middle of the ocean, East China Sea, another symbol of water. She could be seated on her mountain, much like Tara is seated on a lotus, but she's seated on a mountain that's called a Potalaka, and there was a particularly wonderful image of her seated at the Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City. She's called a water and moon Kuan Yin there, and sadly, like many other countries, we've taken objects from their homes and brought them here. And in the case of the Nelson Atkins, they brought a total temple. So she sits in a temple. It's quite dramatic.
Now, where is this, Lydia?
In Kansas City.
Okay.
At the Nelson Atkins Museum. Wow. And then she can be depicted holding a wheel, kind of like the wheel of life. And this new huge statue of her on her island was put up for the millennium in 1999-2000. And she has a huge wheel like you would see on a ship that she's holding, and she's facing the South China Sea. So her name there is Nam Tai Kuan Yin.
And is that her connection with sailors, maybe, or,
yeah,
or just travelers?
Travelers and sailors. She was carried up and down the coast of Asia. So the routes were both water and land that she moved on. That particular story on her sacred island is that a ship was wrecked, and then they tried to get back onto the ship, and she helped them then on their voyage as it went on. And so there's a cave where she supposedly spoke to them. And right at that spot is where they built a temple. So you can hear the water rushing in and out of that cave that kind of moans just because of the tides.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how the natural environment would give you some sound.
Yes, yes.
And reinforce that idea.
Those auditory spiritual experiences.
Yes, yes, yes. And mountains, too, are often seen as the mother. You know, Mother Mountain, they're all over the world. I just came from Bavaria, where many of the mountains have Mary churches on the top. So
do you have a favorite Kuan Yin, Lydia? I mean, I know you've seen her in so many places. Is there one that stands out for you?
Well, I love that one in Kansas City. I think she's pretty special.
Okay.
And she's on our shores, so you don't have to go to China to see her.
Well, when we get off, I'm going to Google her and see if I can put her on my Facebook page.
Oh, well, that'd be good. Or I can even send you a PDF of the one that I made a banner of.
Okay, okay. So was there more you wanted to tell us about Kuan Yin in China, or did you want to go down to Cambodia?
Well, I think that what the important idea is that she traveled. And because she was protecting those who traveled. She was also seen to work miracles. Her stories just go on and on. There's several fabulous books about her, heavily researched, that went into the early texts about her, the sutras, and uses some of the illustrations I've been describing. And then just the folk knowledge, you know, as all studies of goddesses, the stories that people pass on as folk knowledge and tradition are very, very important to research and try to make the connections to the, in quotes, higher learning or the book knowledge. So that's really important as far as Kuan Yin is concerned.
Now, does she have a lot of apparitions attached to her stories? Is that usually part of it?
Yes, she does. Yes, she does. She will show up on the ocean, quiet the storms. She would. One story was that a family was to get on a boat right after the Second World War, and the grandmother said no because Kuan Yin stood on the water and told her no. They didn't get on, and that ship ran into some Japanese torpedoes, and everyone was lost. So the grandmother said that Kuan Yin saved them.
Mm.
And she saved the sailors. She saved people from cancer. The stories go on and on. Much as the miracles of Mary or miracles, traditions of healing worldwide.
Is there a book that stands out for you that if people wanted to hear about her, read about her miracles, one that is your favorite?
Well, the one that's the biggest one, I'm here looking at it, is about an inch thick, is really called Kuan Yin, The Chinese Transformation of Avalokiteshvara, which is the Buddhist Bodhisattva in Buddhism. And it's by a Chinese author, C-H-U-N dash F-A-N-G Chunfang Yu, Y-U.
Okay.
So that would give you a huge background on Kuan Yin.
Okay.
Would take many radio shows to talk about.
It sounds that way. So does she have, besides the sacred island, does she have many temples over in China?
Yes. She is in, my experience of going to the temples is she's usually, there's a Buddha, usually, and then she's off, she's kind of hidden, so she's behind the Buddha. And metaphorically, I think that can be read several ways, is she's the energy that manifests in the Buddha, so she's the Great Mother, but she also has to be protected so that she's, you go through the courtyards to find her in the temple.
Well, I what popped into my mind as you said that, it's sort of like she's in the cella, you know, more in the Holy of Holies kind of a thing.
Yes, I agree. That's a good metaphor for her.
Okay.
And again, I visited maybe, well, how many did I visit? I'd really have to think, but probably a dozen or more on a trip through China for a month. And she was always there in some form.
Mm-hmm.
And I would light a incense and a candle. And I often left prayer flags. You know, I make these Tibetan-type prayer flags with goddess images on them. So I left her all over. Who knows?
Well, and you know, when you were talking about the spirit money, it reminds me of the many times we've been to different Chinatowns in San Francisco, LA, other places.
Yeah.
And you can go into these shops and actually buy paper items representative of something you want. I mean, sometimes it's a house or you know, a car or clothes. I mean, it seems like there's no end to these objects they've made in paper. And so is that sort of the same idea of the spirit money? You burn that in the temple, and if you're burning a car, well, maybe you're asking for a car or...
No, I don't know that you would burn that image in the temple of a car, but you could do it certainly in another way. In your own space, the burnings I've seen in temples are actually of the papers that they have there.
I see. So that would be for your home altar use.
I would think that, but you need to ask someone in that from that tradition because I'm not, certainly not an authority on that. But what they've done with those papers in the temples is they will fold them, and a bit like origami, into these wonderful shapes. So that you could get like a pine cone or a pomegranate that's all folded with these spirit papers. And then light that. In fact, on the island, Putuoshan itself, right by this place, the cave where the Kuan Yin appeared, there's just a huge, looks like a furnace almost, that you take and put your spirit money in.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing.
and you're making me remember more and more things here. I mean, another thing that happened in San Francisco, and I don't know whether you had occasion to read about this or do it yourself or hear somebody else do it, but what they didn't, or maybe this is just sort of a way for the temple to make money, but if you would buy a statue of Kuan Yin and leave it overnight at the temple, the priest or priestess of the temple was actually supposed to infuse the statue with the essence of Kuan Yin. And before you did something like that, I mean, you know, had to take it seriously, because that meant when you took it home to your home altar, you had to, you know, give it water every day and make offerings and
treat it with the same idea
that it was a deity in your home.
Right, and you feed it. You bring flowers and particularly oranges. They seem to like oranges on their table offerings to Kuan Yin.
Okay.
So, which brings up, when you mentioned San Francisco, I think the temple there is really the one I visited anyway in Chinatown was a Tian Hao one, T-I-A-N-H-O-U.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, and she's more seated on a throne, usually with big lots of garments.
Mm-hmm.
And so she looks more like the Queen Mother that I was talking about of the West, Shi Huangmu. Kuan Yin is younger, it seems, in many of her depictions in that Tian Hao.
Okay.
And they're connected,
mm-hmm.
But the image tradition is a little different.
Okay.
They do sell Kuan Yins, though, at the Tian Hao temples.
Well, yeah, that's actually what I happened to do there. You know, that was the image you could buy, and even though I knew it was Tian Hao, and she's a Taoist goddess, I believe, mm-hmm. if memory serves right,
mm-hmm.
it all still worked.
It all still works, and it goes together. There's another temple in L.A. that I went to of Tian Hao, and it was similar, except the one in San Francisco is what, on the third floor. So
yeah, third floor walk up. You have to be willing to walk up those three flights of steps, but it's worth it when you get up there.
Right. I recommend visiting there if anyone's listening and hasn't done so.
Well, just real quick before we, before we get back to Asia, where was the one in Los Angeles?
Well, you know, I would have to. I can't remember.
Okay, that's all right.
I was with a friend who drove me there. And I can't tell you. I'm sorry.
I understand that. When Roy drives, I'm not sure. I couldn't tell anybody how we got there either.
And that Los Angeles is a rather large place to drive.
Uh-huh. So now, how are things different for Kuan Yin in Cambodia, or are they? Or is it pretty much the same thing?
What, from my observations again, it seems like she traveled, and she then morphs in, or takes on different aspects. In Vietnam, her name is Quan Am, Q-U-A-N, capital A-M. And the temple I visited of hers in Ho Chi Minh City, which is Old Saigon, she was standing, holding the willow and pouring water, and she was very dark. So it was dark wood, but I immediately thought of the connections to Black Madonnas.
Mm-hmm.
And so that she was really a dark Kuan Yin. Then right behind her was the most amazing room of mothers. I walked into it, and it was U-shaped with about six mothers or five mothers facing me, and five on each side of me, and offerings in front of all of them. And I was told that it was where you went to make your offerings to the mothers for help. And you made them to both the, for good things to happen, and then to try to keep bad things from happening. So one side were the bad mothers, and one side was good mothers.
Now,
and
I thought you were going to...
Both sides had offerings.
Now, I thought you were going to say on one side of the room you asked for wonderful things to happen, and on the other side of the room you asked for all the horrible things to happen to your enemies.
Well, and that might be part of it. That might be part of it.
Okay.
But definitely both the good and the bad ones had many offerings, and they were overseen by a larger group of mothers that I was facing. So I have this... photo of me standing in the room of the mothers. It was very, very powerful, actually.
So altogether, so you're talking about there were more than 10?
Oh, yes. In fact, I think there were 15. There were five,
okay.
And five.
Okay, okay.
And they were sitting there like those Tian Haos. So they were seated with crowns and then, you know, kind of those dangly, not earrings, but something coming down from their head. Pieces,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then elegant robes, and they were dark. Again, they were dark.
Mm-hmm.
It stood out to me.
Well, and forgive me for going back to China here, but and I might have this wrong. Feel free to correct me. China's not real big on religion, so is she? But obviously, she must be very popular. Does the government just sort of ignore her veneration, or is there any awkwardness or conflict there?
Well, I was there in 2003, so I can only speak from that experience. I don't know if it's different now. At that point, the temples were still being very well taken care of, but certainly in Beijing, when I had requested to do that, I wanted to see them, they gave me a guide who was just as fascinated to learn about it as I was, because she knew nothing. But she was studying English, and so she wanted to be a guide. And so we kind of explored the whole idea of a divine feminine, and she seemed to be quite open to it. That temple in Beijing wasn't very well, there weren't many people there. Others along the way, there were more, but there definitely were thousands at her sacred island.
Okay.
On the South China Sea. So I guess if you believed in her, you would feel that you needed to go at some point in your life to her island as a pilgrimage, just like people want to visit Guadalupe in Mexico City.
Right.
She has millions of pilgrims every year.
Right.
Or, to some extent, the Madonnas in Europe.
Well, now, does she have a unique way in which she fits into goddess history around the globe?
Yes, I think she fits into the Great Mother.
Okay.
History. So whether it's Isis, Mary, Kybele, Magna Mater, the Great Mother of Rome, Guadalupe, Grandmother Spider in the Southwest, she to me is one of those ancient mothers. And her traditions all dovetail or mirror many of the other stories of the mothers around the world.
Okay. Is she one of your favorites?
Well, you know, it's hard for me to say what one's my favorite because I'm always looking for and creating. And the one I'm creating is where my energy is going. When I was doing China, I really loved her, and I did half a dozen images of her. I have one where she has 1,000 arms.
Wow.
That was a challenge.
I bet. So are you going to make a banner with her with 1,000 arms?
I did.
You actually did. Oh, I thought maybe you were sketching it out or something.
No. She's one of the Chinese Kuan Yins that I've already created.
Okay.
And my most recent one from that area now is from Southeast Asia, from Angkor Wat, where in Cambodia, where Buddhism seemed to come from India. And one of the kings, with a very long name, 12th century, built this huge temple complex. Angkor Wat's the largest temple complex in the world. But what's so amazing about it is there are almost 2,000 female images on the temple that you never hear about or read about.
You mean besides the Asparas?
Well, these are Apsaras.
Apsaras.
Are dancing. And then there are Devatas, D-E-V-A-T-A. And then there are these various goddess images like Lakshmi from the Hindu tradition, or the one that totally fascinated me was one wringing her hair. And in the Buddhist story, when he is being tempted by all the demons, there is a female comes and wrings her hair and makes a flood to kill all the demons. So this figure wringing her hair was very important in Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand. And I had never seen it before, and I was just dumbfounded.
So do you think they're attributing magical powers to hair?
Well, I think that's part of it. I really do. And now I've found the earliest image that I can find of this is actually from Bactria, which is present-day Afghanistan.
Wow.
And it's about the second century before the Common Era. So in some Buddhist ivories, there is a figure wringing her hair.
And okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead. My brain just leapt in a direction, and I'm going to have to ask you a question. I'm sorry for cutting you off. Please finish your thought.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right. Well, when I first saw her, I thought, what is that pipe coming out of her head? What, you know, it didn't make sense. And it's actually on the water department in Phnom Penh in Cambodia. And I said, there she is. And then I see the Ministry of Water or whatever it is. So it's a perfect icon for the water department. But then you would see it. It's on Angkor Wat, it's in one of the temples there. And then I saw it repeated in Laos and then in Thailand. So I looked up her name, and it's, again, one of those mouthfuls that you have to spell to even, but it's Niang Priyadarani, which means Lady of the Water, I guess. So, again, there's a figure being attributed to the sacred substance that none of us can live without, and that's water.
And so is she also the one with the hair?
Right.
Okay. Well, here was my leap. Okay, my leap in logic, and I just wanted to bounce this off you. All right, you said, and I think you said there was another one of these images. Did you say found in near Afghanistan or something?
Well, that's where the earliest one I can find.
The earliest one. My thought is, do you think there's could be any connection between this idea of the hair being magical and powerful and why in these countries now it must be covered? Because, I mean, I know the veil goes back to pre-Islamic times. So.
Right. Well, it could be, Karen. I've never thought of that, but definitely the hair is a big part of the story on the temptation of Buddha.
Ah.
And, right. And Mara comes and saves him by wringing her hair. Or Mara's a demon, sorry. And the Priyang Narani is the goddess' name in Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand. I don't think it has a name in these Bigram, Begram ivories from Afghanistan or Bactria. That's the area that Alexander the Great came to. And it's a lot of art influence came then on that same road, the trade road, the road of conquest, and so you find very Greek and Roman looking art in Bactria, which is Afghanistan.
Okay. Actually, you just answered a question for me. I actually had some images of a goddess from Bactria, and I had a heck of a time finding where Bactria was. So that's Afghanistan.
Right.
So now you weren't saying that you, or maybe you were. Let me just ask you to repeat if you don't mind. Did you actually see Kuan Yin in Angkor Wat, or it was the other images?
I did not see Kuan Yin in Cambodia.
Okay.
These other images are, but the one, there's an image there that is totally fascinating. It's not Kuan Yin. They call her Ye Dep. And she is one of the images of the leper king from Angkor Wat that was moved to the National Museum. And they felt like, it helped the people of Cambodia finally rid themselves of the Khmer Rouge and all the horrible atrocities that were going on. So there's a shrine to her right in the middle of kind of the street where she is, offerings are brought to her. They actually put lipstick on her, paint her fingernails, and supposedly the king and queen of Cambodia go and give her offerings because she represents the fundamental civilizing force of the nation.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's actually quite amazing.
Well, and I remember when I was researching Angkor Wat for my Sacred Places book, I was running across usually women scholars, writing about the Khmer people and possibly worshiping the goddess Mer, M-E-R, and all of the also the indigenous rice goddesses in that area too. I mean, I can't remember their names all of these years, but you know, like that, I found that really interesting too. You know, just like we have the wheat goddess Demeter, you know, then we have the rice goddess.
Ho Ino Nigar or Nagar is the rice goddess.
Yes.
And it makes sense that that's the substance of sustenance in that area is rice.
Right,
so
absolutely.
You would be making offerings for the rice goddess. You also do that in Indonesia. All the shrines in the various fields, they are attended every day to the rice goddess, Dewi Sri. So it... at a basic level, humanity seems to want to revere who gives them sustenance on a daily basis of the what they need to live, food and water.
And it seems like the further east we go, they haven't let go of her, like we have in the West, where we have to rethink her and relearn her into our lives. She's been present for them for a much longer period of time.
Well, certainly on the continuity factor, much longer than we are as a young nation. And then even with our indigenous peoples, we can't go back the thousands of years that the Chinese peoples can.
Right. Well, we have about probably maybe 8 minutes left. Lydia, unless my other guest calls in late, are there any Kuan Yins besides the few we talked about in the United States that, you know, stand out for you that maybe you think listeners would want to know about or maybe...
I think you could visit her in probably any large museum. I mean, she's in the Art Institute of Chicago, the Freer Gallery in Washington, D.C., the Met... the LA County Museum has a wonderful whole section on Chinese art. She's in there.
Right.
So look for her.
Yeah, well, I mean, you'll go to your phone book or a phone book. Listen to me. Am I dating myself? Go to your yellow pages on the internet.
And just Google her, and you'll find lots of images.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah, go to, you know, Chinese temples in your neighborhood or Buddhist temples in your neighborhood.
I'll bet on Wikipedia, I'll bet if you put in, if you Google Kuan Yin, I'll bet you get images of her. I've been so amazed in the last year or so about the image bank that's on the Internet.
You mean free to use images? Or
Yes. I found a site as I was doing research on Italian art that had 25,000 images of Renaissance art that were better than the entire slide library that I taught with 20 years ago. I mean, I just cannot believe, and the quality was great. So I'm rather amazed.
So how do you find this, Lydia?
I've noticed when I'll put in a topic, like I it was probably Michelangelo, in the case of finding this site, and then as you as the Google choices come up, then it'll say images up, and then I'll start clicking in there, and I go through them rather quickly because I know. I have my eyes trained to look for certain things, and I. I should try it on Kuan Yin. I have not, but I was. That's how I found this Renaissance art site, and then I was working on that site. Was working on the stories of connecting the muses and the creative energies in art of the Renaissance, and they had fabulous material that I can click into. I can pull them off and put them on my laptop and use them in a slide presentation.
Right. Or maybe I wonder if you can even use them in a book. I mean, are they free to use?
It depends. Sometimes it says there's no, it's free access. and sometimes they're restricted.
Okay.
So you definitely have to pay attention to that.
Well, in our last few minutes here, why don't we turn our attention to the girls? What is the last goddess banner you made, and what's the next one, if you have a next one planned?
Well, the last one I finished was a dancing Neolithic goddess from Spain, and the next one I'm going to paint is another Spanish goddess, La Dama de Ibiza, Ibiza. These are for a goddess conference in Madrid in October, and so I'm working on that. I also just did finish an Apsara from Angkor Wat. The girls right now are hanging in Glastonbury at the town hall for the goddess conference, which opened Wednesday today. So it's Thursday morning there now, our time, but this morning they would have been doing their opening ceremony in Glastonbury. So they'll be there through Sunday, and they'll carry them through the streets and up the tour. I sent them before I left for Italy to the conference.
I can just imagine how spectacular that's going to be. I mean, having the girls there in procession in the street for that festival is like icing on the cake. You know, it's just going to make it so much more spectacular. I mean, you have been so generous, Lydia. I mean, you've allowed me to use those on numerous occasions, and you are the generous mother, and we thank you for for the contribution of these wonderful ambassadors of Goddess. That how many years have you been making them now?
Well, this is 15. They began 15 years ago in Ephesus, Turkey, at the Celsus Library in July. So I was 60 when I started, and if you had told me that I would make 250 Goddess banners by the time I was 75, I would have thought, that's not possible. But it has happened, and I'm past the 250 now. I'm probably about 255. And people ask me, how do you find them? Really, they find me.
I bet.
There's an image that needs to be brought out. It seems to keep showing up, and I say, okay, you're going to be a banner. So my next year they're going to fly in Switzerland in St. Gall, and they're going to parade through the streets there in May. And I'm going to be doing a banner for that event of Frau Holle, H-O-L-L-E. She's one of those mountain mothers.
Yeah.
Who's part of that Germanic tradition. And I found an image of her on the Internet.
Well, you know, I am sure with all the goddesses out there, they are going to keep you around for a really long time so that they all get a banner in their honor.
Well, I don't know, but I've certainly enjoyed it, and I'll keep going as long as I'm able.
Well, you have brought us all so much with those girls, and I thank you so very much. And listeners, if you haven't already seen these goddess icon spirit banners, again, please give yourself a treat. Go to Lydia's website, lydiarule.com, or I'm sure they can probably just Google your name, Lydia, or goddess icon spirit banners, and it'll all just pop up.
Yes. Well, you'll have, when you get to my website, click on art and then banners, and you'll get them.
Okay,
pop up.
And are you having any classes anytime soon, or
well,
helping people
kind of
buy your spirit banners? Or
I will be at the ITP, Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, in Palo Alto in September, and then the banners are going to Australia in October, some of them, and then some of them will be in Spain. And that is pretty much happening the rest of the year. I've had a really busy year up till now, so I'm looking forward to a little bit of breathing room.
Well, you've been a bit more busy in the last month than people are all year, so. Well, thank thank you so very much for making time to be on the show, especially since you just got back from traveling to three countries, and here you're making time and staying awake, you know, to be on Voices of the Sacred Feminine again. So I thank you so much, Lydia, for all you do to contribute to Rebirthing Goddess. Bless you.
You're very welcome, Karen. Thank you very much for all you do.
Well, good night, and I'm sure we'll talk soon.
Yes. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, listeners, seriously, go to Lydia Rule's website, www.lydiarule.com. You will want to see her goddess icon spirit banners because these images really are ambassadors of the sacred feminine. You know, it's really interesting because they can hang in places that it might still be awkward to talk about a feminine face of God. And it really is as if they are ambassadors, and, you know, they open doors, especially in the early days, you know, because Lydia has been making these for a while now. But I see by my switchboard that our next guest is there waiting, so let me go into the switchboard and say hello to Gloria. Hi, Gloria, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
I sure can. I can hear you fine. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Oh, I'm excited too.
Well, let me tell listeners a little bit about you first, just in case they haven't found your beautiful website or discovered your book yet, because through this interview they will learn more about you. But we're talking now, listeners, to our second guest tonight, Gloria Amendola. She is a psychic intuitive who reads for and works with clients in a variety of ways. She utilizes different card decks and other divination tools, bringing through the departed for those who wish to connect with them. She works with clients to uncover the meaning of dreams as well as the healing energy of those dreams. She's a certified dream teacher and follows in the footsteps of shamanic mystical traditions. As a writer and teacher of esoteric subjects, she's devoted to the study of the Magdalene Mysteries and the Sacred Feminine. She's been researching Mary Magdalene since 2000 when she wrote a play about her. I believe it was called Magdalene's Mind, which has been showcased in New York City. She's given a staged reading in Seattle in 2004, and it's been translated into Finnish and Russian for production in those countries. Magdalene's Mind is included in the complete Idiot's Guide to Mary Magdalene by Lisa Bellavie. And she has also just finished her first novel, The Tower and the Dream, Awakening to the Ancient Voice. And we'll mention it again, but while it's here in front of me, let me mention Gloria's website. It is her name. It is Gloria Amendola.com. So, Gloria, again, we're going to be talking about the sacred places of Mary Magdalene in France tonight. I'm really excited.
Oh, thank you. It's one of my favorite places in the world. Oh, feels like home.
Well, you know, that's something you and I share, and it's, I don't know about you, but, you know, I thank Goddess. You know, many years ago I was a part-time travel agent, and it was at the perfect time because it allowed me to travel places on my budget, you know, so I got to go a lot of places. And do you find that some, you know, it's almost like there's some sort of DNA memory? You just sort of connect with certain places in some way that it's hard to even language.
Oh, I so believe that. And for me, quite surprisingly, it was the land of the Magdalene in southern France. The minute I got into the woods of St. Baume when we were climbing to her grotto, it was on that earth that I connected. And I've traveled pretty extensively throughout the United States, Canada, and in other parts of Europe and the UK. But when I got into the forest lands of southern France, something happened that changed me forever. And even, you know, nine trips, I've been there nine times just in the last 4 years. And I could not stay away.
Wow.
I could not stay away. And as a matter of fact, I'm going in September.
Well, you know, I'm a little rusty on Mary Magdalene sites, and you know, and I, you know, there's no etiquette here. So if I say something wrong, you tell me, because I want to keep the information straight in my head. But when you said St. Baum, I'm trying to remember why that's familiar. Is that where the cave is? She was supposed to have lived out her life, or is that where her relics are in a church? Something.
Well, that's true. The legends say that she came in through Saint-Marie de la Mer.
Right,
which is near Marseille, in that whole area, in that whole region of southern France. And it is said in some of the legends that she spent the last 30 years of her life in those incredible Druid mountains, that energy up there, basically communing with the angelic presence. So it was in, I'm not saying that I necessarily believe that particular legend that had her there at that time. I do believe she was there, but I believe it was actually at a different time in her life. But nonetheless, her legends are connected there, and there is a relic of an alleged relic of her in that grotto, in that cave, and it is the most beautiful and feminine and soft forest that you walk up, and you make this pretty good ascent up to the grotto. And it's just there where I connected. But they do have her skull in St. Maximine, which is a few miles away. It's at a basilica, and it's the alleged skull of Mary Magdalene, which they parade around every July 22nd, Magdalene Feast Day, and yell, Vive la Madeleine, because they understand who she was.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had a fella in the building where I live. His last name was Maddalena, and he was from France, and he was telling me about how the people still there are so devoted to her. Yeah, I mean, you know, and even with all the Dan Brown stuff that came out, and you know, he, and what was it? I'm trying to think. With the church was trying to debunk something, and they said no. I'm a little foggy on it, but he was saying, you know, absolutely, the people still, you know, believe in all of these things now.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because the day. The day after the Da Vinci Code movie came out, I think I flew to France for the first time. Ended up in Paris at Saint-Sulpice, where the Catholic Church, now this is funny in my opinion, the Catholic Church in Saint-Sulpice had these bulletin boards, portable, standalone bulletin boards with pages and pages of why the Da Vinci Code wasn't true. The place was packed with people. And yet, the minute you go into, and I've only seen this in France, at St. Baume and at Saint-Sulpice in Paris, as you walk in, the very first side altar of the of Saint-Sulpice to the
right. On the left-hand side?
No, as you walk in to the right, the very first altar there.
Okay.
You have a Pietà, and I've only seen this in St. Baume and Saint-Sulpice. The Pietà includes Magdalene.
Ah,
so you have the mother, you know, the classic Pietà with the dying Christ in her arms, or the dead Christ. I mean, that's the Pietà. But in both of those, you have the Magdalene, and the Magdalene is deeply connected to him in a very intimate way, and it's very physical. And I don't think that would have been portrayed throughout art history if there wasn't a real connection between the two. You know, given Hebrew laws at the time and so on and so forth. So it was hysterical that here they were refuting the whole thing, and yet within the church they have a Pietà with Mary Magdalene.
So just in case my listeners don't know what a Pietà is, it's when the woman is holding the dead body of Jesus, and it's usually his mother, but you're saying that in this case it was Mary Magdalene holding the body.
No, what I'm saying in this case is it's the mother holding the body, but instead of two people being in the Pietà, there are three.
Oh.
And the third person is the Magdalene, and she kneels. She's on the ground, kneeling more by his body in connection with it in a different way than the mother. And so I just believe that it's a depiction of who she truly was.
Well, you know, this might be going off track just a tad, so forgive me, but you brought up St. Sulpice, and I can't resist this sort of train of thought. I've been to St. Sulpice. Every time we go to Paris, I don't miss it because it's thought to also be a site where an old Isis temple used to stand.
Yeah.
And then, and it had these Priory of Sion connections because of, you know, Dan Brown. Mm-hmm. And what, and I don't know whether you noticed when you were there, but when you, and I don't know, forgive me, I don't know what they call the different parts of the church, but as you're walking down the center aisle and you look to the left at this, the sort of the entrance at the center of the church, they had a stained glass window over now what's been, I think, turned into a confession box. They actually had a stained glass that, in my opinion, it was really, it would be really hard to say it was not a stained glass that represented the Priory of Sion. They said that it was representative of St. Paul, but whenever you saw St. Paul stained glass, the overlay was different. Because this was also, St. Sulpice was also supposed to be where the Priory of Sion met. And that's, yeah, that's what I was trying to remember a second ago when I was talking about my friend from France with the last name of Magdalena. He said, without a doubt, he said the people in France do believe the Priory of Sion really did and does exist in spite of all the debunking. Now, you know, I don't know for sure. You know, I'm not an
expert.
I've
met people from the Priory.
Met
people who, I met two people who claim to be from the Priory, and I would have to say that most likely, in my opinion, they either are or they are connected in some way.
Okay. And do you have a, well, I mean, you know, there's so much I want to ask you, but before we get off the Priory of Sion, and I think this all is going to tie together in the end, we'll come full circle. Do you have any thoughts on if there is still a bloodline and anything about the Dan Brown movie, or did these Priory of Sion people, I don't know, drop any clues to you you thought might be interesting to share, or?
Well, Tim Wallace Murphy is a friend of mine, and he's written fascinating books, two in particular, Rex Deus and Custodians of the Truth. Rex Deus is the first, Custodians of the Truth is the second. And so he, if you read those books, and I know Tim is an impeccable researcher. He's 80 years old now. He lives in France. He's retired from the UK, a psychologist by profession, by study, certainly, and a very successful writer later in life. He maintains, and I trust his word, that the bloodline was in fact real, and that the bloodline of Jesus and Mary Magdalene was a bloodline within a bloodline, if you will.
What does that
and
mean?
That, well, it's its own bloodline within a broader spectrum of bloodlines.
Okay.
And if you read Rex Deus, you'll get the whole blueprint of how it is said that these 24 priestly families that organized after the fall of the Temple of Solomon in Jerusalem, they organized to keep the secrets alive, that they came, really they began in Egypt. And before that, we won't even speculate, but in Egypt, and they moved through the Holy Land. And at the fall, that turning point of the fall of the Temple, they begin to organize and to protect their teachings. And so the bloodline are several bloodlines that exist, and the Jesus and Mary Magdalene bloodline is one in particular, one very potent bloodline, but one, you know, and it has its own name called the Despicini.
Okay.
I do believe that there is an incredible history which, when truth be told, shows how these bloodline descendants were hunted down generation after generation after generation.
Hmm.
And I do believe that they, as a matter of fact, I forgot, I've had so many experiences in this story. I've actually met an American woman whose bloodline to this day, you know, in the current time as well, and you know, she lives here.
Hmm. And I'm a, you know, not fantasy. I mean, you know, you, with good reason, you think she might be legitimate.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And it's interesting who she is in the world and what she does in the world, and that she has the documents that are said to prove her lineage.
I mean, can you say, or is it something she keeps private?
I can't say.
Okay. Oh, that's okay.
Yeah.
So do you have any thoughts on the ideas of, you know, the Templars or the Cathars, if they were actually, you know, really trying to keep the secrets? I mean, does your book
absolutely.
Go into any of that? Or
book two, which I will be writing this fall, will go into the Cathars and Templars. I am a modern-day Templar. Actually, I'm a French Templar, and that's a story in and of itself. And so I take the Templar history very seriously, but I am always looking for the arcane history and the inner circle. And if I cycle back to Tim Wallace Murphy's work on the Rex Deus lineage, the Templars were the warrior monks who were an outer visible extension of the inner Rex Deus lineage. So it was very deliberate what they were doing in history and what they were looking for.
So do you can you speculate on, you know, these theories? I mean, I realize you maybe can't know for sure, and so I'm just asking for your opinion. You know,
mm-hmm.
all of these rumors that you hear about, you know, did the Templars really have the Ark of the Covenant, or, you know, did they become so rich because they were really blackmailing the church with information they uncovered at the Temple Mount? I mean, I realize they became the first bankers, so that could have been a source of their money. But what about the other ideas?
I don't think they were blackmailing the church at all. That's not my sense. And I've studied a lot and traveled a lot in search of who the Templars were. I'm not quite done, and the third book will go into this much more, and I hope to write a book on this as well, a nonfiction book. But having said that, what I have been able to figure out so far, and this is from being on the ground, you know, in France and England and Spain and with different members of the order and all the way the connections are put together, that the Templars most likely, when they were excavating under the stables of the Temple of Solomon, found documents, found alchemical, scientific formula,
mm-hmm.
found genealogies, found artifacts. And in the tour that Renee Burnett and I are doing in Rennes-le-Château in September, we'll be going to a location right outside of Rennes-le-Château in Ailettes-les-Bains, where there are carved symbols on what is considered the Nostradamus family home, wherein one set of three symbols shows carvings that my Templar commander in that region explained to me was showing the Templar cross, the Ark of the Covenant, and Salmon, which is a play on Solomon.
Hmm.
And what he says, very bright guy, and what he says was that in this home, that there was someone of Templar origin, birth, rank, whatever, that must have been pretty pure of heart in some way to be able to touch the Ark of the Covenant, and they connect it with the Salmon with Solomon. And so the legends say that there are so many things buried in the area or were buried in the area because they then brought those artifacts, documents, and so forth that that they knew were there. And the question is, well, okay, how did they know they were there? But they brought them to the area of southern France, especially around the Rennes-le-Château region.
So was there, I think most of our listeners probably know enough of the story to know that, okay, after Jesus is crucified, you know, we think Mary, possibly with child, escapes to southern France. Was there a reason that they chose southern France, or was it just convenient logistically?
No, I think there was a very specific reason. There's an excellent book out there called Jesus After the Crucifixion by Graham Simmons. Graham was one of the authors on Rex Deus with Tim Wallace Murphy and Marilyn Hopkins, and Graham finished this book with his partner Ingrid, and then he passed. He was a longtime resident of Rennes-le-Château, and Ingrid still lives in Rennes, and they make a phenomenal case in the book of why that group, and it wasn't just Magdalene, and there's another piece to add in, why they would have come to southern France. But let me just back up and say, in that basilica in St. Maximin in the Provence region, which holds her alleged skull, there is an account that you could pick up, written in pamphlet form in many languages, that says the official Vatican account says that Mary Magdalene was a part of, was a group of 72 people that came to southern France.
So it wasn't just a small entourage with Joseph of Arimathea or something.
No, Joseph of Arimathea was a shipping tycoon. I mean, this was a larger contingent, and this is what the people of southern France believed. So why did they go to southern France? Well, you know, there are some of very affluent Roman exiles. Romans were exiled to that area. It was an enlightened area. There were many streams of thinking and of religion there. The Essenes were there. The Kabbalists were there. It was kind of like a Berkeley.
Yeah, kind of like a place of higher learning or something.
Yes, higher learning, higher practice, a very evolved place. And if you believe that Jesus and Mary, and certainly the mother, came through the traditions of the Essenes, it said that those communities were there too. So I imagine they had a pretty sophisticated network.
Well, now, are you of the theories that Jesus actually didn't die on the cross, and he, because I think that might have been in Templar Revelations, they point out a lot of things that suggest perhaps he really didn't die, it was staged. Have you heard that, or, you know?
Oh, absolutely, and that was a tough one for me personally. I grew up Italian Catholic. And so, you know, the crucifixion was pretty ingrained into my psyche. And I've had a hard time with, did Jesus die on the cross or did he die afterwards? And I have to say, as hard as this is for me to say, that I don't believe he probably, I'm pretty sure he didn't die on the cross would be my take, and that he actually lived in southern France as well, among other
mm-hmm.
places.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in Rennes-le-Château, there's a very interesting station of the cross, which was painted by the priest Saunier there. I believe it's the 14th station. And in the station, in that particular one, they're carrying Jesus in the tomb, or maybe out of the tomb, we don't really know, but there was a full moon. And Jewish law at the time said that you wouldn't touch a dead body at night.
Yeah, there's a painting about that too. I think they used as an to sort of perpetuate this idea too, and in this book that I read about that. Well, you know, the other thought, I think again this went back to Templar Revelations, and I know you were going to talk about a connection between Mary Magdalene and Isis, but I couldn't help but wonder if they were right in Templar Revelations when they said Jesus and Mary Magdalene might very well have been practicing the Osirian mysteries. Like when Lazarus was raised from the dead, maybe it was an Osiris ritual. And, you know, when she anointed him, she was acting as, you know, like an ancient pagan priestess would have acted. Just curious about your thoughts on that.
Well, I think some of that was enacted in the story of Mary anointing the head of Jesus with the spikenard. That's
mm-hmm.
in the New Testament. I think that was a ritual that kind of anointing the priest king, if you will. There was a certain understanding of ancient mysteries to that. But if you go back and look at Mithras and other stories like Jesus, they're in Isis Osiris. It's really common in many stories of religious figures like this. So it's not even just Jesus, Mary Magdalene, Isis, Osiris. There's even more. And that's when you begin to understand that in the ancient Christian world and how they were conforming the new religion to other pagan religions, that they were usurping many of the storylines.
Well, probably because the pagans were familiar with it, so they wanted to give them something familiar to transition to.
Exactly. temples, churches, you know, were overlaid on temples and on us also, too, because of sacred sites and energies in the earth. But, you know, the dying, resurrecting God, that was a very commonly known ancient archetypal pattern, if you will.
Right, right. And quite frankly, that's how I see Jesus. You know, he was just the next in the dying, rising king line.
Exactly.
This is such interesting stuff. I love this.
Oh, you know, it is interesting. And some people think when you begin to talk like this that you're denigrating the story or Jesus. And nothing could be farther from the truth as far as my world. I believe that Jesus was a phenomenal teacher and healer. I believe that we never got the true teachings.
Right.
I believe those were usurped because the Holy Roman Empire, which became the church,
they had their own agenda.
Yeah, and it's called power over the people.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, I totally agree with you. I mean, because, look, even though I call myself a recovering Catholic, you know, I grew up in Catholic school, all of that, it's the institution I have a problem with, you know.
Yeah.
It's not Jesus by any stretch of the imagination. I think, you know, he would have been a feminist. I think he would have been a liberal. You know, I think I could have got along just fine with Jesus. You know, I'd have had him over for dinner, you know.
Yeah.
you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do.
But, you know, the other thing about going back to Jesus maybe not having died on the cross, and again, feel free to correct me, but I think one of the things that people point to when they want to say he didn't even live is that the Romans were meticulous record keepers, and I think the Romans actually have no record of his crucifixion, so it was just a whole fabricated Christian story, to create Christianity, which also makes me think maybe that's why he could have escaped to France with Mary Magdalene. Is there a flaw in that thinking? I mean, because if there is, please tell me, because...
Well, I do believe that Jesus existed. I believe that Mary Magdalene existed and Jesus existed. What I do know is that tons of records were destroyed, especially when it came to the Jesus story. And there's some very interesting reasons as to why. So I do believe that they existed. I do believe that not only were the records destroyed, but I believe that many in the Despicini bloodline were hunted down ruthlessly and killed. And, you know, I didn't understand why for so long, and I was watching The Da Vinci Code the other night, just happened to come on TV, and I've seen it multiple times, but I said, well, there was nothing else on, so let me just kind of relax and, you know, maybe I'll fall asleep on the couch. And I found myself really engaged in it again. And when Silas, the albino, who's the penitente, who's inflicting the pain and suffering on himself, looks into Sophie Nouveau's face and said, every breath you take is a sin, I understood how they so reviled the feminine and so reviled the sexual act that they would find always warriors or mercenaries like Silas who would go after and kill those of the bloodline.
Well, and also too, I mean, as I hear you saying that, it makes connections in my head as a feminist theologist that, you know, they were so anti-nature, so anti-woman, you know, this idea of the sacred feminine and divine masculine in balance, that was so powerful, you know, and they wanted their own power, and, you know, to take it away from the sacred feminine, you know, that had it. You know, for so long. I don't feel like I'm being very eloquent here, but to me,
what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, they have just turned nature, you know, on its head. You know, sex is taboo. Well, sex used to, you know, it's the life force, for heaven's sake. You know, we shouldn't have to feel ashamed.
Right.
And I mean, there's just so much that has, you know, literally been, you know, turned on its head by, you know, this Christianity making us, reprogramming us, you know, to just think these absurdities, quite frankly. But
to take us totally into separation of our power and our ability as a human, as a spirit-filled human being. And I think Jesus was teaching that initiatory pathway back, whether it was a Gnostic pathway or, you know, I would say that it's Gnostic, but it's also based in the Egyptian mysteries. And that was about direct connection. And well, I'm positive in all that I've seen and experienced around the Magdalene that she was a person of direct connection to Source, to God, to Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't going to have that.
Well, of course not, especially as a woman, too, I think, you know. And they, I guess, wanted to destroy the bloodline because they didn't want some, someone to come and usurp their power, you know.
Right.
Now, I could go on and on, but, you know, there are some points here we were going to cover I want to make sure we touch on. You were going to make a connection between Mary Magdalene and Isis and Mary Magdalene to the Black Madonna. Let's go there now and then we'll come back to this if we have time. We have probably about a half hour left.
Okay. Connections to Isis. I guess in all the years of my work and my meditations or shamanic journeys with the Magdalene, she has always told me that Egypt is the key to everything. She's taught me many things from the spirit realm, and most of what I am taught has an Egyptian connection according to her. And it would make sense to me that if Mary was initiated in the mysteries, the prevailing culture of the time would have most likely connected her to Isis worship and veneration of the goddess.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to write a book on that. Well, I am going to write this. Second book's going to be that connection. But so many times when I've traveled in France, I've somehow found the Magdalene's place name next to the name of Isis. Something in the earth, whether it's a stream or a river or a sacred site or, you know, local hidden stuff, you find Magdalene in the Isis and Isis connected. And that, along with what my shamanic journeys or right brain intelligence has shown me, there are many times when I'm reading stuff in Gnostic Christianity or deeper into the mysteries where I've uncovered different sayings or interesting little fragments, and I somehow can always tie things back to ancient Egypt. So I think that Magdalene in her time would have been connected to Isis. It just makes sense. I mean, there was no Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would have been, and I believe that Jesus was, connected to the Egyptian mysteries as well. I believe he studied, with the Druids too.
And those lost years that we don't know anything about,
yeah.
Supposedly.
Yeah.
R.E. Witt, he's one of my favorite sources, on Isis. I mean, he's a scholar, and he said one of his quotes, and I hope I do it justice here. The gist of it is, if civilization had been able to move forward on a matriarchal basis, that Isis would have been too powerful a mistress to dethrone, because we know her worship spread through, all of Europe. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, for listeners who might not know that and think she was just a goddess, an obscure goddess in Egypt, that's just not the case.
Not at all. And a lot of places where you have churches, especially in Europe, you have that Roman underlay, that layer of history, and, of course, things that go way before that. At Rennes-le-Château in particular, you have a Church of Mary Magdalene, but many people there believe that what lies in the ground underneath the Church to Mary Magdalene was a temple to Isis.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't be such a far stretch, because that's usually the way the church usurped the power of the land and the familiarity of going to worship in a location already, through the pagan traditions, and used that familiarity with the people, if you will. So the goddess, the Isis veneration was all over the place, and I just feel that even if Magdalene was connected to the Essene community, like it is said that Jesus and certainly his parents were connected to them, the esoteric traditions tell us that they were connected to ancient Egypt too. The great healing traditions of the ancient Therapeutae in Egypt evolved into the Essenes as well. And I believe that Jesus was an incredible healer, but I believe that Magdalene was too.
So, I can't remember the name of the docudrama that came out a couple years ago on very limited release, but it was about this guy going through southern France, and he had uncovered this tomb, and it was about trying to see if that was a Mary Magdalene tomb or a Templar tomb.
Oh, that's Bloodline.
That's Bloodline. Okay.
Yeah, that's my friend Renee's. Renee and I are doing the tour to Rennes-le-Château in September, and Ben, who discovered the tomb, will be with us. He's going to show us.
Okay, I'm so glad.
Yes. All
right. So what I'd love for you to talk about is that, you know, what you can tell us more about that. And also, I listened to him at a Q&A after the movie, and he said something about not too far from this tomb, they believe they were going to soon uncover an Isis temple there in southern France. And I wonder if you have heard anything about that or if that's actually happened.
That hasn't happened, and I think if Ben said that, Ben Hammett?
You know, I forgot the name
the
of the
guy
person who did the Q&A, but it was somebody associated with the film.
Okay. Where did you saw the film in Los Angeles?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, it had to be, Renee had to be there, my friend, but it has not been uncovered. Some people believe it's in the location of the Church of Mary Magdalene at Rennes-le-Château. Some people believe that there is a goddess temple underneath the church at Saint-Sauveur above Olette-les-Bains, which is where those Nostradamus carvings are that I mentioned earlier. It's all over the place, but nothing has been unveiled yet because the French government is very particular about letting people dig around there because there was so much digging in the 60s. You know, people were blowing up everything trying to find the Templar treasure, so they had to put laws into effect.
I see. Okay. Well, since the movie Bloodline came out, is there anything more to the story that can be told?
Now, see, that's a tricky one for me. There is much more to the story, but I personally cannot tell it at this time.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have to. Is it Ben? Maybe we'll have to get him on the show if he's ready.
I can connect you with the producer, Renee Barnett, who's a dear friend who we're doing the tour together. Renee is in Los Angeles, and you can connect with her, and I'm sure that she can tell you. And, you know, she's connected with Ben Hammett, and of course, she was a producer on the film.
Okay.
And they could tell you more. It's just not for me to say, but yes, there is much more of a story.
All right. Well, we will do that. So thank you for that. But let's move on because I want to make sure we talk about your book. And I'm curious, Gloria, as a psychic intuitive or, you know, working with dreams, is that how you first became connected with Mary Magdalene, and I assume that sort of inspired this whole quest and book and this direction of your life.
Yeah, it's a very funny story. Years ago, I used to write some plays for theater in local theater, and they had been performed and produced, and it was great fun. But then I had a child. I had my son Michael, and I had the obligations of family life and raising him and so on and so forth. So a lot of years went by, and I did smaller creative tasks as the focus was more on raising him and family and so, you know, and all of that. Well, when he, you know, was getting on in high school years, I said, you know, I think it's time to write another play. And I had gone to a church at the time of someone had asked me to go with them. And I wasn't really a churchgoer, but I agreed to go. And I'm not so big on religion. Spirituality, yes. Religion, no, not really. But I went, and I was just saddened by the lack of any feminine presence. And I said, this just is completely wrong. So I came home, and I said, I'm writing my play about a spiritual woman of the Bible. And I got a bunch of books out of the library on both Old and New Testament women. And I swear to God, it's as if Mary Magdalene came alive on my dining room table as a holographic, you know, as a hologram, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
and said, pick me, pick me, pick me. And I thought, oh, my God. and I hate to say this, as evolved as I was about certain things, I was completely unaware of who she could be. Being indoctrinated into Catholicism, I was still
Believe in the old story, huh?
Yeah, Jesus Christ Superstar, you know, that was my most current and independent, you know, idea of who she could have been. So when I decided, okay, I'm going to write a play about her, so I started my research, and I was absolutely shocked. I would stay up till like 2, 3, 4 in the morning and just read. I just couldn't stop reading, and that's how it began.
Wow. Well, you know, I think this is one of the biggest mysteries of our time, quite frankly. And, you know, maybe it's just this, you know, my love for the romance. But, you know, I think it feels like we have all of these little pieces to the puzzle. You know, the Isis, the Mary, this whole bloodline, all of it. But it's like we're missing enough parts to prove it. You know, it's almost like something you have to take on faith.
Yeah, it's you have to really be dedicated to this journey because it is extremely challenging. It is really the quest for the Grail, and that's your own transformational process as you seek the deeper truth, the hidden truth, what was hidden away from us, and yet what the guardians of the Grail have always kept going, that Rex Deus lineage. They've always seeded consciousness throughout the generations to keep the story alive until one day the truth would be told. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that the truth exists in the Vatican archives.
Mm-hmm.
I'm convinced. And I do believe that they know the true story. And I do believe it will come out in our time. I think we're much closer. And I think at least we're starting to find some evidence, like, you know, the Gospel of Judas, the Nag Hammadi text, the Dead Sea Scrolls, those all tell us a very different story.
Yeah, and I think, you know, they're transitioning the minds of the people from these programmed robots to, you know, starting to plant so many seeds that the story could have been something different so that people's minds will be open, I think, when maybe this is all finally revealed.
Well, you know, those of the guardians of the Grail, the Priory, whomever these people truly are, it is the same lineage and the same purpose, no matter who they were, Priory of Zion, this one, that, Freemasons, you name it. They kept truth alive through medieval tarot, through the troubadour tradition, through art history, through stained glass windows. I mean, I have pictures of Jesus and Mary Magdalene together on altars and stained glass that are stunningly beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see the marriage window in Limoux outside of Rennes-le-Château in September, and it's just beautiful. Why
is that the one where she looks like she's pregnant?
No, that's the one that Margaret Starbird often features. It's on the Bloodline logo. That was from Scotland. I think the Isle of Mull, where they're holding the right hand, which is a symbol or a sign of the nuptials, and she looks pregnant.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
People will see it on my website if they go, because that was, you know, that's kind of the tour image that we've used.
Well, now your book, The Tower and the Dream, how does that fit into this whole story? Is this your personal journey finding a more authentic Mary Magdalene?
Well, the first book, this will be a series of five, and I've been working on all five, but the first one is done. And in that
is that
novel,
The Tower and the Dream?
The Tower and the Dream.
Okay.
Yep. The Tower and the Dream, Awakening to the Ancient Voices. What happens is the main character in this story has an experience. It's like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the tarot deck and the imagery, but in the trump cards, there's a card literally called the Tower. And when somebody, and I do this in readings a lot for people, when they have the Tower card come up, their life is either going to or is in the process of completely falling apart and breaking down, much like the astrology of this summer says our world is doing. We're just in this
mm-hmm.
incredible transformation of seeing all these things in the old that don't work, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the two things that lag behind are politics and religion.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just fighting like crazy because that's where the power is. Whereas technology, just, you know what I mean? Science is moving forward. Technology is moving forward. But we're still doing this battle in religion and politics because of the money and the power.
Right, exactly.
So I don't know. It's I think I lost my thought on that one.
Well, I was asking you sort of a synopsis of The Tower and the Dream. How did
God. Okay, I'm so sorry. I forgot about my own book. That's crazy. So the main character in this story has that experience, and everything falls apart in her life. And as she tries to make sense, she heads out to the American Southwest for some R&R. And that's when her journey begins. And she begins to have visions of Jesus appearing to her, tipping her the Grail cup and sacred symbols and geometry. And she's hired a tour guide, and she goes to these different sacred sites throughout New Mexico. And all of a sudden, she's awakening. And she begins to hear the voices. So at the beginning of each chapter is an ancient voice, whether it's Isis or Jesus or Teresa of Avila or Jacques de Molay of the Templars or Joan of Arc. I mean, it's someone different in each chapter. And it's this beginning metamorphosis of before Magdalene becomes a front and center teacher from the spirit realm for her, which is more of book two. She is uncovering the energies of the Southwest in the United States and all the things that are just helping her to awaken.
Sounds really interesting.
And how, when we change like that, how, when we awaken, we then come back to our lives and deal with family and friends and situations and jobs and so on and so forth, because this is what people are wrestling with, is what do you do when you begin to awaken and change, and yet you're in relationship in the world.
Right. Well, yeah, we talk about that actually within goddess spirituality, because when women really start to get this and they see the oppression and they understand how it all came about and what keeps it in place, I mean, it's almost like some run away from it, because it demands transformation, you know, if you're really going to move forward. You just can't stay stuck. I think you would go crazy.
Yeah, once that vibration begins to change, and once you begin to awaken, well, I know my personal journey, which some of my personal journey is flavored, you know, peppered throughout the novel. You know, it's, you know, some of it's personal and some of it's fictional, and it all blends together. And you know, that's the art of the novel, I think. But in my own journey, I remember times of meditation or channeling with friends and girlfriends hanging out and being asked, do you want to keep going? Because once you get to this point, you're hitting the point of no return.
Yeah.
And, you know, really having to give that careful consideration, because you don't know what that means. You're like the fool in the tarot and you take the leap of faith.
Oh,
but
so absolutely.
You know, but then at some point, like you said, you can't turn away from it.
Yeah, I couldn't, and I'm hearing you certainly couldn't. You know, it's like, or you know, maybe you could call it like, you know, curiosity that killed the cat. But but you know, you have to keep moving forward. Then, you know, and it does, it changes you in profound ways. And I mean, like my family, for instance, they're still Catholic, living in Louisiana. You know, they're so worried for me. They're afraid I'm going to burn in hell. And when I say, don't worry, there's no hell, they just freak out, you know.
That's true.
You know, and we haven't even had the conversation about Mary Magdalene and Jesus, you know. but, yeah, I think this is such important stuff, and that book sounds really interesting. Maybe we'll do a book exchange or something. I'd love to I'd love to read it. Well, I want to make sure we talk about your upcoming tour, and I'm really curious about your last talking point, which was the Divine Feminine. How does it sync up with the Mayan calendar?
That's good stuff.
So why don't we go there, and then we'll close things off with your tour information and some of the sacred sites of Mary Magdalene you're going to see on the tour.
Okay. How does the Divine Feminine sync up with the Mayan calendar? Well, I've read stuff on the calendar in 2012, lots, and I've talked a lot, you know, done local talks and stuff like that, and some of the best information I have found was through Johann Kalman, The Mayan Calendar and the Transformation of Consciousness. And basically, to shrink some very complex information into very simplistic terms, he says that in the calendar, interwoven in the calendar, are these nine underworlds. And we're concluding the eighth underworld, which began in 1999, ends in early 2011, like maybe January, February. And then the ninth underworld comes in and has to complete itself on an evolutionary basis in about 10 months, which is extraordinarily fast. So if we think things are moving fast now.
Right.
The interesting aspect of the eighth underworld is that the right brain impulse had to come onto the planet because we were so out of balance.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the right brain is the, you know, the, that feminine impulse had to permeate itself into the consciousness, into, it had to weave itself back into our collective consciousness because Christianity had removed that from the equation.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, he makes a fascinating point that in the characteristics of these different underworlds, it makes it ripe, you know, like in Les Miserables, there's nothing more potent than an idea whose time has come.
Mm-hmm.
The idea about Mary Magdalene being the beloved of Jesus, the wife, the mother of his children, that's why the Cathars, it's one of the reasons why the Cathars were burned and the Inquisition happened, you know, the heretics. The Templars, it's a little more complicated. But this has been around a long time. But what made it really stick? What made, you know, The Last Temptation of Christ was out there, Martin Scorsese film, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, my friend Henry Lincoln's book with the other two guys, that opened a lot of people up. But the Da Vinci Code occurred in the eighth underworld, and look at what happened there.
Mm-hmm.
That was a worldwide phenomenon.
You're not kidding. I remember the truth squads and all the documentaries, and I loved it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it just really, I mean, opened up people to the idea of a feminine face of God who didn't even consider it before.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then to begin to look into not only that history, but then the history of other traditions, certainly ancient Egypt was, you know, very much connected. And you had the, you know, you always had that male-female counterpart, because in truth it's the same, it's a unified energy, and it's both male and female.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus actually teaches about this in the Gnostic Gospels. I think it's the, I don't know if it's the Gospel of Philip or Thomas, but he talks about male becoming female and female becoming male. And
mm-hmm.
it's the whole alchemical process within ourselves as well. So
mm-hmm.
it's interesting that the impulse of this eighth underworld held the feminine to balance us. So it wasn't only just seeing a feminine face of God, but it was also remembering that imbalance within ourselves, we have to have both male and female energies.
You know,
that's alchemy. So
okay.
it was working on the internal level, it was working on the outer level, and it was hitting us in a place of our spirituality.
Okay, so alchemy in the psychological sense, as opposed to turning something into gold.
Right. I mean, base metals into gold, you know, some people say yes, they did it. Some people say no, they didn't. But the larger analogy is being on your spiritual quest. And
right.
in ancient Egypt, it was known as the great work of blending the both, using both hemispheres of the brain to move forward.
Well, and the Egyptians were so much about balance, too. It makes perfect
right.
sense. You know,
yeah.
things weren't in balance. They were scared to death of chaos. Well, so what, I mean, this divine feminine syncing up with the calendar, from your, forgive me, I forgot the gentleman's name who you got a lot of your Mayan calendar information from, is there a sense of what's in store? I mean, if anyone can say. I mean, are we just looking at an enlightened time, or are we, you know, or do you think we're looking at Armageddon and starting over again with a more balanced society? Or, I mean, I know that's a huge question, but I just wonder.
It is a huge question. I mean, I've heard so many different things, and if truth be told, I don't know, and perhaps it's not scripted.
Yeah.
I think that I would like to believe it's a transformation of consciousness, and as the ninth underworld comes in 2011, which is, you know what, 6 months away, it's going to move so fast that it's going to bring us into this enlightenment. Will the Earth respond? Are we responding? I do believe so. I think we're already seeing evidence of Earth changes.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
it's also accelerated by our lack of understanding in the corporate world globally
mm-hmm.
that unless we do business right, we're not going to be around to appreciate the mother, Mother Earth. So So I don't know, honestly.
Right. Well, it would be easy, wouldn't it, if this Christian idea of the rapture, well, not the rapture happened, but this idea that the end times sort of come, and the end times really is just the end of sort of the status quo that hasn't been working for most of us, that end. And, you know, and maybe everybody's enlightened because the divine masculine and sacred feminine appear as an apparition that they get on television that's broadcast all around the world, and they say, get it right now, you know, there's both of us, this isn't supposed to be a male-dominated patriarchal world, you know. That's how I'd write it, but
I think we do have to be in balance on all levels with the masculine and the feminine, and I am encouraged that more and more women are taking positions of strong leadership, especially in America, because it's so desperately needed for that balance for us moving forward. I don't know what's going to happen. All I do know is that I've always heard, work on your vibration, you know, work on really being aligned to the truth and to your heart. And
so it's not like you've had any dreams or psychic visions or anything like that that might leave us any clues.
Well, I will leave one. If you want, I'll tell you one.
Okay.
I was leading a group a couple of years ago, and everybody was going into the meditation part of the group. And I was just holding the energy, as I always do for a group when I'm facilitating. And for some reason, I then went off, and Jesus appeared to me in this, and I don't know why on that night, as opposed to any other time. And he showed me a period that we would endure as individuals on this planet that would go dark, and that solar winds would be prevalent. And I didn't even know anything like solar winds existed. It was not in, I'm not a super science person, so I didn't know that solar winds were real. But he told me that the solar winds would come fast and furious, but they would be a matter of days and not weeks. You know, so it would be a very quick event, and then we would move into the new world.
Well, that's detailed and at the same time vague, provocative. I think that's a good way to describe it.
Well, we are going into solar max, as far as I understand, next year, and there is something called solar winds, so there is some science to this.
I'm going to have to Google it.
yeah, it's true. So I don't know, but I think I survived it.
Well, Gloria, I apologize that we're running out of time here. We have about 2 minutes. Can you tell us a little bit about your tour, what's coming up, and if you still have places on the tour for other people?
We do. We are, you know, filling up. We do have some room left, but we are filling up, so people need to contact me, and they can find that out on the website. We're going to stay in the Languedoc region so that we're not traveling all over and, you know, just rushing from one place to the next. We're going to stay in the Rennes-le-Château area so that we can really walk the land, walk the earth, be there, drink the local water, which is pristine, and go to the different mountains, the different rivers, all sacred, all with legend, and yet spend time in the hilltop village of Rennes looking at what the priest Saunier was actually doing, what kind of truth was he preserving, and Ben's going to take us through how he got into the head of Saunier and found his clues. And then we're going to walk to these areas, which Henry Lincoln, and I'm sure we'll see Henry up in the garden there, but, you know, that is a living, breathing, organic temple on the earth there that has real formations that you can only see from above. So who the heck constructed this place?
Right.
And you know, I mean, it really begs the question of some really interesting layers of history way before even the Druids. And there is such a history in the area, the Roman baths and so forth. So we're going to go all around. We're going to spend a lot of time walking connected to the earth, you know, sitting in a very powerful seat of Isis with ley lines going through it and going into the source of the Magdalene and, you know, the river we have to cross to get there and, you know, climbing in mountainous areas and spending a lot of time in Rennes and seeing different local stained glass windows and heretical symbols and paintings which show you that the artist knew that Mary Magdalene was the wife of Jesus. And Tim Walz Murphy will join us, and he's going to give us some real good info on the Rex Dais lineage. So it's going to be a combination of a lot of things.
Oh, it sounds incredible. So when is it?
It's September 19th to the 25th, so we're going to do 7 days in the Languedoc, and we are going to do a special ceremony for the autumn equinox full moon, which is really stunning there. And We're going to walk the land and see what this temple of antiquity is that still exists in the earth in such a beautiful place, and why the ancients kept going there over and over and over again, Jesus and Mary Magdalene being really just one layer of history.
Okay. Well, that was our 90-second warning about 10 seconds ago. So let me close by, I guess the best thing for me to do is to give your website again, GloriaAmendola.com. That's AmendoLa. And Gloria, let me just say this has been wonderful. I wish I'd had you on for the whole show, and maybe, you know, maybe we'll have you come back. And
oh, I'd love to. It was really nice. Thank you so much.
Well, I've really enjoyed this. This is one of the subjects that really still, you know, lights my fire.
I know that feeling.
So the best of luck to you with the tour and the books and everything else you're doing. And seriously, let's stay in touch, and I'd love to get in touch with the Bloodline people.
I'll put you in touch with them, yep.
Okay, and we'll have them on the show as well.
Okay, well, very good.
Well, Gloria, thank you so much. And again, listeners, Gloria Amendola's website is www.GloriaAmendola.com.
Thank you so much, Karen.
I've never cut it this close before. All right. Well, good night, Gloria, and thank you. Mm-hmm. And listeners, thank you so much for tuning in with us again this Wednesday, and please come back again next Wednesday night. Good night.